Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
I don't get it. Podcast.
Hello, everyone. This is Ashley.
I was like, I'm pretty sure I'm supposed to say my name now, but I think it was already said. Well, that was weird.
Ashley, Lauren, and Daddy.
Daddy's here today.
Yay, Daddy.
Yeah, Dad, you got to talk into the mic better. You got to get all the way down there. Yeah.
Okay, say Daddy.
Daddy.
Okay.
Well, if you guys didn't know, Naz is in Paris this week, so we are recording here at the I Get Eddie home in Virginia, and we thought this was a good opportunity to do the I Don't Get How You Could Have Surgery and Not Feel It and Not Wake Up podcast.
That's a great name for the podcast, but I was thinking we should start with tomorrow's Thanksgiving.
Oh, okay.
And do we have any favorite Thanksgiving memories?
Oh, Lauren.
Daddy, do you have one?
Every Thanksgiving's a memory.
Remember last year?
What was last year, Dad?
Do you remember?
Last year was a disaster.
Yeah.
You want to explain?
No, we've explained this terrible Thanksgiving like 14 times on here.
Oh, okay. Well, the food didn't come.
But Ashley, do you have a memorable Thanksgiving?
I feel like my only Thanksgiving, like, you know what's ironic? I feel like my most prominent Thanksgiving memory is probably the worst Thanksgiving. And that was the one where we went to Capitol Grill for Thanksgiving.
Was it just the four of us?
Yeah.
I don't remember it. We do that so often. Like, they blended together. No. I meant we go to Capitol Grill, the four of us, so often that it blends together.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's all. Really, really flourishing in Thanksgiving memories. And I had Jared come here for Thanksgiving because I was like, oh, Thanksgiving is a bigger deal in my family than Christmas. Because with Christmas, it's just the four of us. At least we have people over for Thanksgiving.
That's true. And we still don't even make a big deal out of Thanksgiving.
Mom and Dad aren't very, like...
They're not, like... Mom likes to decorate, but she's not very festive.
Yeah, she does. She loves to decorate. Dad, do you have anything to say?
I don't like to cook.
Yeah, Dad just hates cooking. He tried to make a reservation at the restaurant down the street. I will say it is a 5-star restaurant. Like, with what are they called?
A Michelin restaurant?
Michelin restaurant is a Michelin restaurant. But Dad tried to make a reservation for the restaurant today... After he already bought the turkey and the stuffing and all that shenanigans.
All he had to do was make one dish.
He made a reservation for 11 people. And he was like, so I made a reservation for 11 people. I know you're going to get mad, but should I cancel it? It's like, yes, cancel it. Dad has this thing called the 5 F's. Dad, what are the 5 F's?
Friends, family, football, faith.
Food.
Okay, great. Well, you'd think that would be the most Thanksgiving holiday. The most Thanksgiving thing.
You can do all those things without cooking.
Dad.
That's so sad.
It's so sad. You really would rather spend like over $1,000 and just cook and like be cozy at home.
We're going to be like
snuggly
one of those grandmas or mothers with no like, my parents taught me this recipe, you know?
It's just, absolutely not.
My parents taught me how to make a reservation.
That's so true. Except I will be using the stuffing recipe.
Yeah, when I get older. All right. Well, that's our little Thanksgiving memory, everyone. You guys already had your Thanksgivings because it's Monday.
You guys are probably really bored by that conversation. We're sorry.
All right. So we had a conversation a couple weeks ago. I don't know how it came up with anesthesia and how we don't wake up. So, Dad, do you want to like bring us to the process
of going
in?
Maybe you want to explain that Dad is an anesthesiologist.
Dad's an anesthesiologist. And so, explain the process of like going into surgery. Like, what do you do to prep and all that stuff?
Well, Lauren, I don't know about that question. It's a little
People get nervous, like, oh, I don't want to go under anesthesia. So, like, what do you actually have to do when you show up to the hospital?
Dad's actually going to do a video about this at work so that he can show the patients before
they go
in.
See? People want to know.
The most important thing that people need to understand is what you do as an anesthesiologist. It's a lot more complicated than people think.
What you need to do is get closer to the mic.
There you go.
It's a lot more complicated than people think, because really what we're there for is to keep you safe. You know, you can think of surgery as kind of being an assault on the body. It's not, obviously not a natural thing.
Well, that's scary. That's a scary way of putting it.
Well, you know, that's the way it is. It's not, it's not a natural thing. The body reacts to having surgery a lot of different ways. It's a very stressful physiologic thing. And it's our job to make sure not only that you're safe and unaware during surgery, but to make sure that you're in the proper condition in order to even undergo surgery. You know, there's a lot of people with underlying medical problems that put them at increased risk for bad things happening when they have surgery. So it's important for us to make sure that all those medical problems that people might have before they come to surgery are stabilized and well taken care of and not out of control. Because if you don't do that, you're at much increased risk for having problems during and after surgery.
What if people don't realize that they have an underlying problem?
Well, that's part of the job of screening people appropriately before they have surgery. They come in, you know, they get seen by their surgeon. The surgeon decides that something needs to be done, and then that sets off a whole process whereby people have to go and make sure that they're in the right shape. You get blood drawn in order to find out whether there are things going on with you. You've had physical exam. You probably have a medical history going in there. You might know that you have high blood pressure or diabetes or sleep apnea or something like that beforehand. And if you do have those things, we have to make sure that they're maximally taken care of before they go to surgery.
Okay. Well, so smoking is also one of those. So
that's correct. It takes 6 weeks.
Okay, so you don't smoke for 6 weeks before surgery.
Correct.
No way.
That's what I was wondering.
You're not supposed to smoke for 6 weeks before surgery. It takes that long for your lungs to clear out all the smoke and residue from smoking. Ooh. So, yes, if you're a smoker, you should abstain from smoking forever, but at least for 6 weeks before surgery.
So what happens if you need to have emergency surgery and the person's a smoker?
Different story. I mean, you have no control over that. You just have to have an understanding that the patient's a smoker, might have, you know, what we call reactive airway disease, have asthma as a result of their smoking, or even if they've been a long-term smoker, they might have emphysema. And that has a significant impact on your ability to recover after surgery if it's not managed properly. So if you come in for emergency surgery and you have a lot of these underlying conditions, you know, you explain to the patient, we have no choice. You're coming in now. You have to have emergency surgery. You're at increased risk for, you know, certain things happening to you because you're not medically maximized prior to coming in.
Okay, so let's get to the real big question here. How do you have surgery and be cut into and opened without waking up?
Or feeling any of that.
Well, let's take a step back.
Probably
okay?
Have to, yeah.
You got to take a step back for a second. If you look at the brains of reptiles versus the brains of human beings.
Human beings.
There's a significant difference. You know, amphibians or reptiles or quote-unquote, and I don't mean this in a bad way, lower forms of life, brain is obviously nowhere near as complex or sophisticated as a human brain is. Brains of lower animals like that tend to, they react to things. They don't think. It's a lower form of their brain that works. So if something happens, there's kind of like an automatic reaction to it. And as you go up through, you know, teleologically how people develop into human beings, you get layers and layers and layers on top of that automatic kind of brain to a brain where you think, you have consciousness, and you react to things in a much more complex fashion. Well, our bodies still have that primitive brain, but it's overlaid with all this
cerebral
cortex. So what an anesthetic does is it essentially puts to sleep the conscious portion of your brain,
the
higher level of your brain where you're awake, you're aware, you think.
I would love to have that permanently gone.
But your body still reacts to the stimulus that occurs when you have surgery. So let me make this a little bit clearer. I can get you off to sleep because I give you medications that put your cerebral cortex, the thinking portion.
How do you target just that area?
Well, you don't. That's a good point. The drugs are made to target that area, but there is overlap. And giving medications that put the cerebral cortex asleep has effect on other areas of your body as well. And that's part of being trained as an anesthesiologist, is to understand that you're giving this drug in order to put somebody to sleep, but it also has these other side effects that you have to minimize or correct.
So you guys ever been sitting around your room with some friends and you're like, wow, we got great snacks now, but we forgot the alcohol? Well, that happens probably around the country a zillion times a day. So at some point, somebody got the bright idea of having alcohol, wine, beer, liquor delivered, and it's called Saucy, the alcohol delivery app.
Saucy delivers your favorite wine, beer, and liquor right to your door on demand. Now, if you're in the Los Angeles, the Bay Area, Chicago, San Diego, or Sacramento, your Saucy order will arrive to your door in under 30 minutes, ready to drink.
That's pretty nuts. Under 30 minutes. That's cheaper than most other delivery
it's
services.
It's faster.
I mean, what did I say?
You said cheaper.
Oh, okay. I meant faster.
For the rest of us, Saucy will deliver beer, wine, and liquor to your door in 2 days or less nationwide. That's really good for Thanksgiving, like that already passed. That's really good for Christmas
and New Year's.
Amazing.
If you've got the Saucy app, you can get a fully stocked bar on your phone. There are no order minimums, no delivery fees, no running to the store. And for a limited time only, you can get $15 off when you download the Saucy app and enter the promo code GETIT, G-E-T-I-T. That's the Saucy app spelled S-A-U-C-E-Y. And enter the promo code GETIT for $15 off. Get the Saucy app today and use the promo code GETIT.
But let me get back to what I was saying. If I get you off to sleep using, you know, the medications that we use, and if you want, we can go over what they are a little bit later on. It puts your cerebral cortex asleep, but it doesn't quite put to sleep that area or that reptilian or amphibian area of your body that automatically reacts. And the way that you know that that happens is I put you to sleep. I know that you're asleep during the surgery. All your vital signs are good, but as soon as they make an incision, your body reacts by your blood pressure going up, by your heart rate going up. Those are all functions of that lower brain.
Yeah, yeah.
That the lower the portions of your brain, the harder it is to get them asleep. The easiest part is to get your cerebral cortex, your brain asleep.
Is that kind of like when you're drinking alcohol? I don't know if I'm comparing this or you're drinking alcohol and you feel pain less if you hurt yourself because you're dumbing down your cerebral cortex a little bit.
That is correct.
Woohoo. Science.
Good job, Lauren.
That's correct. So the drugs that we use are generally targeted to affect the cerebral cortex more than any other portion of the brain. Although you can give enough to overdose somebody and you can put the whole brain asleep, but you really have to overdose somebody. But what we try to tailor to do is get people asleep, unaware of what's going on, don't have any sensation, but yet their automatic functions of their heart rate and their blood pressure and so forth are still able to be maintained.
I still don't understand how you can just target one certain area.
The connections and the chemicals of that area of the brain
people do in like labs. They study years and years to make this medication that targets a specific thing.
Correct.
Well,
or they find it out by accident. I mean, that happens also.
That's a whole other like absolutely mind-boggling thing as to like how you discovered a drug that can put to sleep one certain area.
It's the same thing of the entire world of drugs. Like how did they target migraines?
They're all targeted.
All this stuff.
How did they do this over literally the past 125 years?
It's more than 125 years. It was back in the mid 1800s is when this started.
So how were they able to do it?
They used drugs.
Tell me the history of anesthesia.
Well, that's a very complicated and controversial area also. There were two men who have been credited with providing the first anesthetic. One was a guy, a dentist actually, by the name of Morton at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston.
That's where you went, Dad.
Yes, that's where I trained. And then there was another guy at Emory University. His name is slipping my mind right now. I'll come back to it. Who was actually probably the first person to have done it before Morton did.
Yeah.
But Morton publicized it a lot better than the guy from Georgia.
And this was all in the mid-1800s?
The mid-1800s.
The importance of advertising, y'all.
Yeah, it's all it's same thing. So Morton got credit for it, but the Georgian was the one who actually provided the first anesthetic, and that was with ether.
What's ether?
Oh, that's the thing that you put over your mouth.
Right, it's ether.
It looked kind of, you see in serial killer movies.
And actually before that in England, I may be talking out of school here, but in England, they use chloroform. And
what? How did they not die?
Chloroform. Well, they just.
Chloroform, guys, if you didn't know, is like the number one like killer when you watch the Investigate Discovery Channel.
Queen Victoria was giving birth and they gave her chloroform at the time. I don't remember the exact timing. It probably was after the Morton demonstration of ether.
That can we, if we're done with this explanation, or you want to keep going? Because I want to talk about epidurals.
Oh, well, Lauren, no. Okay. Epidurals are far down here.
All right.
Far down.
Continue on.
It's Crawford Long was the doc down in Georgia at Emory that gets the credit for the first anesthetic, if you look at it properly historically.
Okay, so how did he experiment on this? Like on animals? Because animals, you say, don't have the same brain.
No, these guys were doing it on humans.
Wait, that's so crazy. What in the world? That's like that movie we saw. What was it called, Lauren?
Die and you come back to life. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Damn it! What is it? Flatliners?
Flatliners.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So they don't test on animals. They test on themselves. I hope you get good
They're
compensation.
Tested on themselves or like or on humans. Willing humans?
Willing humans.
Well, these guys did it on willing humans. Okay, so if we can go back for just 1 second and talk about like the layers of the brain, and I told you that we're very complex because we have a cerebral cortex, but the amphibians only had these brain stems. Mm-hmm. Well, anesthetics tend to put to sleep the areas of the brain from the top down.
Yeah.
So the first thing you do is you go to sleep, you don't have any consciousness of what's going on.
Yeah.
But your hearing is a very, very primitive,
oh.
a very primitive sense.
Oh.
So sometimes, you know, there's a lot of controversy or speculation about this, but sometimes people say they hear things under anesthesia.
Yeah.
Well, that's because possibly you've put the area of the brain to sleep like the cerebral cortex, mm-hmm. but you haven't given enough to take care of that lower portion of the brain, which is the hearing.
Yeah.
So we always say that the hearing is the last thing to go.
Okay.
So sometimes you can think that somebody is asleep, and they are asleep. They're not conscious, but on some unconscious level, they can still hear what's being said. And if you want to talk about awareness, which is where I think you're going, there are actually two kinds of awareness that you can have under anesthesia. One is, if you're not given enough anesthesia, one is called explicit awareness, where you know that there's something going on, you are awake, and you feel something.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's implicit awareness, where you've given enough medication for somebody not to be aware or conscious of what's going on, but you haven't gotten rid of the hearing, and they hear stuff, and although they don't consciously remember that they heard it, it's in there. Mm-hmm. And if you ask some people the right question after surgery, you can elicit the fact that they actually heard something, although they weren't aware that they heard it.
They weren't aware that they heard it.
Right.
So the explicit...
Well, so let me give you an example. There were some studies done where the people got put off to sleep, and I don't know exactly, you know, what drugs they used, how much they gave, and so forth, but they would put them off to sleep, and then they whisper in their ear saying that when I come to see you after the surgery, post-op, after the surgery on the floor, I'm going to hold up a pencil, and I want you to say bird.
Cool.
Okay?
Uh-huh.
And sure enough, they go and they visit him post-op. They bring a pencil out, and the person will kind of like say, I just thought about a bird. You know, something like that. You know, that kind of study.
That's also the kind of the point of where you used to study with – well, like if you play things overnight, you can retain the information, you're not That's actually right. learning.
I actually did that when I was in graduate school and medical school. I would put a tape recorder in my ear and I'd fall asleep. And I know that I learned a lot better when that happened.
Good Same tricks, kind of everyone.
You know what's really weird? Well, I don't know if this... No, never mind.
I have a question about with explicit awareness. Do you see their heart rate going up and down because they're really aware?
That is not a reliable sign. Okay. Generally, if people are light, you know, they have light anesthetic and they're not quite entirely asleep, mm-hmm. your expectation is, and you do see that their blood pressure goes up, their heart rate goes up, but it's not a reliable sign. There are people who have had awareness, explicit awareness, where they didn't show any signs of having high blood pressure and a high heart rate.
Now through December 25th, the 23andMe DNA kits are on sale. 23andMe helps you understand what your DNA can tell you about you and your family story. It's named 23 for the 23 pairs of chromosomes that make up your DNA. A 23andMe DNA kit is a perfect gift for everyone you love. There has never been a better way to give a gift of genetic discovery to your parents, siblings, aunts, grandparents, and everyone else that's on your list. It's the one gift that you buy the entire family and will be unique for each loved one. With 23andMe's ancestry composition report, you can explore where your DNA is from out of 150 plus regions worldwide. You also get a wellness kit where you learn how your genes play a role in your well-being and lifestyle choices, and you learn your traits and explore the genes behind your appearance and senses. So if you want to give an amazing gift that anyone would be so thrilled to receive, now through December 25th, get 30% off any 23andMe kit. Order your DNA kit at 23andMe.com/get it. Very important to use the code GETIT. That's the number 23andMe.com/get it. Again, that's 23andMe.com/get it to get 30% off any 23andMe kit. So get going on your shopping list today.
All right, so let's say you're saying that the hearing goes last. So basically, like, once you get into that lower cortex...
It's not even the cortex. It's lower than the cortex. Okay, it's not the cortex anymore. It's the brainstem.
So you hope to get there, but with some people, are you worried about getting that far down? Because if you do get that far down, you literally could put a person to sleep to death, kind of like a dog.
That's an exaggeration. No, you want to get the depth to that point where they don't have any implicit awareness. You want to get that portion of their brain asleep.
But how close to death do you get people?
You don't get that close. I mean, if you go a lot further, you can, but you don't.
Their heart doesn't stop during surgery.
No.
But you're turning their brain off, basically, as much as it can go.
You're turning their brain off.
Yep. In order for it to turn off to...
not feel or be aware.
Correct.
But you can actually turn somebody's head off to death, right?
You could overdose somebody with anesthetics.
I see that on ID all the time.
You see that on ID all the time.
Yeah, they steal drugs from, like, the drawer, and then they go put their wife to sleep. And then, like, I don't know what happened. She just woke up like this or didn't wake up like this.
It's a very – this is probably not – I don't know if this is correct the way of saying it. It's not really a an easy thing to do, to overdose somebody. Because in addition to us putting people to sleep, obviously, when you put people to sleep, you put their brain stem to sleep to some degree also, because you stop from breathing. Your breathing is automatic.
You have to tell people.
You don't think about breathing all the time because it's automatic.
That's part of your automatic your primal thing, you turn it off when they have surgery.
Correct, and that's why you have to be able to breathe for people during the surgery.
Yeah, so people also need to know out there that you are in the room the entire time, or a nurse anesthetist.
Correct, either me or a nurse anesthetist or both.
And they're monitoring your breathing and your heart rate and all your vital signs?
Correct.
Okay, so
with the amount you give someone, is it depending on their weight?
Generally, it's weight-based. It's weight-based, generally, yes.
So we had a lot of people on the message boards when they thought that this might be a topic on the podcast say that they have heard doctors talking while in the surgery. Mm-hmm. So you basically just said that that is actually relatively normal.
No. That is not normal at all.
Okay, not normal, but like happens.
Very rarely, and that needs to be explained.
Okay.
People sometimes misinterpret.
Okay, yeah, because we got a lot of comments saying that people felt awake during it. Like, out of the 10,000 people in our group, there were too many people who said that they had some memory of the actual surgery while being anesthetized.
Well, again, that's very complex. And again, it does happen. It generally happens under circumstances where there's emergency surgery, where people are unstable, and you can't give them a lot of anesthetic because their vital signs and their blood pressure and so forth are so low that if you give more, you have the potential for actually making things worse. It definitely happens, but generally under those circumstances. If it doesn't happen under those circumstances, quite frankly, it could be that, you know, somebody made a mistake and didn't give the drug they think they gave, or didn't turn the vaporizer up where we use our inhalation anesthetics. It happens infrequently, but it does happen. Now, I just want to – it's important for me to say this. A lot of people misinterpret what their anesthetic should be. For instance, if you undergo a colonoscopy – the way that it's generally given today with a drug called propofol and have a propofol infusion, people mistakenly don't call it a general anesthetic. Now, it's a general anesthetic in the sense that it gets you off to sleep and your breathing can really slow down. But
you're not breathing for
it. But it's really very deep sedation. It's very deep sedation. And people can sometimes, depending upon their resistance, their size, the proper dose hasn't been given, they can wake up intermittently and go back to sleep.
Is there a difference between being under the anesthesia that you do at the hospital and being under sedation?
It depends upon – we do sedation in the hospital also. It depends upon the procedure that's being done. Technically, colonoscopies can be done with something called fentanyl and Versed, which is when you don't go to sleep, but it just really sedates you a lot. But it can be uncomfortable. So? Well, I have to explain why a colonoscopy might be uncomfortable.
So you might be feeling the colonoscopy?
Yeah, because it's
pressure.
So if people expect that they're going to be entirely asleep for some of those kind of procedures, or where they do a procedure where they're going to take a bump off of you and they use local anesthetic, all you're really doing is trying to get people sedated enough that they can tolerate the injection of local anesthetic around the area that they're going to take out. And that doesn't require you to be entirely asleep.
Okay, so question. Is that like wisdom teeth?
You know what? Not being a dentist or an oral surgeon, I don't know what they do. I know that they do use propofol for it, but I don't know to what depth and what amount that they give propofol for wisdom teeth extractions. Some can be probably done with propofol, which gets you off to sleep like a general anesthetic, or you can give a low enough dose where you're just sedating the person to make sure that they're not anxious and can tolerate the injection of the local anesthetic to pull the tooth out.
Is that so painful? Like the... The injection? Local anesthetic?
Oh, yes. People don't like, getting stuck with needles.
Well, I don't mind it.
Well, some people do. People are freaked out by needles.
Lauren, were you under anesthesia for your
Both
of us had laughing gas because you wouldn't let us go under for our wisdom teeth. And why is that?
Because I know the bad things that can happen, and
think that an anesthesiologist should be the one doing anesthesia.
Not necessarily. You know, there are lots of oral surgeons who are able to manage an airway, but I see the worst case scenarios, so I want to avoid them at all costs. So I prefer...
If you can handle an injection for such a small operation, do it.
Correct. That would be my recommendation.
Okay, so you mentioned fentanyl before.
Mm-hmm.
And all I think about is how many people die from fentanyl overdoses. Yeah.
Okay, so fentanyl is a very, very potent synthetic opioid.
Yeah.
Opioid is like morphine.
Isn't this what Prince died from?
I don't know. People just mix it with their heroin and it is
described as being 50 to 100 times more potent than morphine.
Crazy. Okay?
So, you know, somebody will take 10 milligrams of morphine because of some pain that they have for whatever reason. Well, if you think about giving 50 to 100 times that dose,
it's insane.
Yeah.
So when you give
morphine, you give 10 milligrams. Uh-huh. If you give fentanyl, you give 50 to 100 micrograms of it.
So why is it becoming so laced and stuff? Like, how are we getting a hold of this?
Well, people they just pretend. So I just saw a documentary. People pretend to have cancer. People use it to get their pain away and stuff.
Like, why would you need anything more than morphine or like a big dose of morphine?
That has to do with pharmacokinetics, the way that drugs are distributed throughout your body and how long they last in your body. Mm-hmm. Morphine hangs around for a long time. Fentanyl, you get a very intense analgesia, which means it reduces pain from it,
mm-hmm.
but it doesn't last. It goes away very, very quickly.
Okay. So it's like a jolt.
But it's kind of like a big jolt. That tiny amount of fentanyl causes a significant amount of respiratory depression.
Okay?
It's all about respiratory depression with narcotics. The reason people die from narcotic overdoses is because it goes to your brainstem.
And it just tells you to stop breathing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. A lady came up to me in the airport last week, and she said she was a fan. She was saying hi, but then she started crying because she was going home because her best friend's son died.
Overdose?
It was cocaine.
Totally different drug.
It was cocaine laced with fentanyl.
Oh, so it's like an upper and a super downer?
They brought him into the hospital immediately, put him in surgery, but nothing.
Damn. Well, that's
not
very
surgery.
Sad.
They would
put him in something. They started doing something on him. Mm-hmm. But it's just laced with so much now. But why? But
it's cheap.
Oh.
It's very, very cheap.
So it's like crack?
Well, I don't know.
I just know that heroin and fentanyl.
Fentanyl.
It's YL. Just mixed a lot together.
You guys know how difficult online shopping can be because you order something and you're like, wow, this is not as cute as I thought it was. This doesn't fit. And I thought it was going to fit because it's my size, but it doesn't. Well, we have a solution for that problem because you're probably a different size depending on the brand. And there's a thing called a tote that's going to help you figure out these issues. They're going to take the stress out of getting dressed. They're going to find the right styles in your right size delivered to you. And when you're done, you can just send it back if you don't want it anymore. La Tote takes your measurements and ratings and learns not just your size in one brand, but all the little nuances about how you like your clothes fit so they can figure out what's going to fit you best in every brand that you order.
Rent pieces that fit, send them back when you're done, repeat. Simple as that. With La Tote, you can rent unlimited fashion. Just wear, return, and discover fashion that fits you better. It'll take the stress out of getting dressed.
I just said.
Exactly. Go to latote.com. That's LETOTE.com to get started. Enter the promo code GETIT. Very important, guys. Enter the promo code GETIT, GETIT, at checkout to get 20% off your first month. And again, that's latote.com and enter the promo code GET IT for 20% off your first month. Okay, so let's get into epidurals because I know a lot of bitches love it.
Even though I have a
You're jumping around a lot. There's a lot to say about a little.
I have more to say about that, Lauren. Lauren is really anxious about
epidurals. I just know that a lot of people have like their very strong opinions.
I know. That's why we're going to get into it. But, Dad, I wanted to talk about how like, okay, so you know how people obviously like get open heart surgery, you get cut open, blah, blah, blah. And you're totally fine because you're asleep and you can't feel it. But what if there wasn't anesthesia? Would you die from the pain? Like, they didn't do surgery, obviously, in, like, the early 1800s because there was no way to put you to sleep because apparently, you know, the body just couldn't handle
Or control blood loss.
Yeah. So would you die from the pain?
You couldn't tolerate it.
You couldn't tolerate it?
No.
Oh, so then you would die from the pain.
I think you'd pass out, and then you continue home with the surgery.
It just doesn't make any sense because nobody's going to subject you to that.
Voluntarily? Well, I mean, it's like either death or the biggest like amount of pain you could ever feel.
That would be murder. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
But would it be? So it would be death by pain.
You couldn't do – I mean, it's kind of – the reasoning is kind of strange. You just – can you die from pain?
Yeah. My pain alone.
That's a good question.
Oh, wow.
I would think – somebody have to be awful sadistic to continue to do something like that to get you to the point where you would die from it, somebody's trying to kill you.
If you're in the 1800s before there was surgery,
they wouldn't do that.
You'd be like, okay, well, you're either going to die from this disease or we can try to get it out of you. Well, I would be like, well, if I'm going to die, at least try to get it out of me.
Usually the thing back in the Civil War, when this was about just after the Civil War, when all this stuff started or, the big thing was amputations.
Yeah.
All right.
So yeah, exactly.
They give you a shot of whiskey, give you a rag to bite on, and it came off.
So
you
know? Precisely. I get they just they endured it.
That's a little different than cracking your chest.
Right. And also then what you're talking about, they didn't have like X-rays and all that stuff to be like, oh, you got a tumor on your lung, let's take it off. Cause like you'd be like, all right, I'll just die.
Right.
I don't know that.
Yeah. Well, Dad, what do you think that we've missed out on so far?
Well, it's not that we've missed out. It's just I've made a lot of statements that really I feel sometimes need a little bit of qualification and so forth. I'm really speaking in generalities.
Yeah.
So I just hope people don't think that I'm being entirely comprehensive here. There's so much more to say about all these things. We're just like scratching the surface. It's important for people to understand.
I think I just want people to understand in like layman's terms what happens. And I think I understand
he did a good job.
But okay, do you want to tell us like when you show up the day of surgery and like what drugs you give them?
Sure.
What to expect?
So
we already talked about making sure that you're prepared medically for it, that all your underlying disease things are taken care of and managed. Then you say you're optimized for surgery, and it depends upon obviously the kind of surgery that you're coming in for as to what kind of anesthetic you're going to get. But if generally, we'll start off with somebody comes into the preoperative holding area, they'll meet their anesthesiologist or their nurse anesthetist or both. They'll review their record and their chart with them, verifying, their underlying medical problems, the medications they take, whether or not they've had any problems with surgery before, examine them, listen to their heart and lungs. Evaluate their airway, which is really important. By evaluation of airway, meaning if you're going to have a general anesthetic, that's going to require intubation, which means put a breathing tube put into your trachea. How easy it's going to be in order for that breathing tube to be put in.
Which you put in once they're asleep.
We put 99.9% of the time we put them in when you're asleep.
When do you not?
You don't when you think that you're not going to be able to manage the airway and be able to control it. It can be bigger people.
You got a terrible airway.
Or people who have...
That's true.
It's either large people, correct, or people who have had cancer that restricts their mouth opening, or they have cancer of the neck. Under those circumstances, this is what you don't want to have happen. This is like the anesthesia nightmare, all right? You get somebody in the operating room. You give them all these potent drugs. You get them off to sleep. You stop them from breathing. And then you can't breathe for them. Okay? Now, most of the time, you know, we have a mask and we squeeze the bag and we can ventilate people.
Worst case scenario, that's what you would do.
That's what you do. But sometimes, again, the anesthesia nightmare, you go off to sleep. You give them drugs that stop them from breathing. We give paralytics. We actually paralyze people before we put this breathing tube in. Uh-huh. And the reason we do that is to open the vocal cords to put the breathing tube in. Uh-huh. It's not always necessary, but that's generally what we do. If you get them off to sleep, you give them paralytics so they can't breathe on their own, and you can't breathe for them either with a mask or to get that and that breathing tube
Why
in.
Why couldn't you breathe them for the mask?
Because sometimes people's tongues are so large and their anatomy is such that you can't. That's what when people snore at night.
Yeah.
So a lot of people stop breathing because of their airway. That's sleep obstructive sleep apnea. Mm-hmm. These are the kind of people that you have to worry about something like that happening.
How many times has this happened to you?
To be able to get somebody off to sleep and not be able to ventilate them? I can honestly say never, because if that were the case, then I'd have to call a surgeon in emergently in order to trach the patient, and I've never had that done. We have a lot of these things were a big problem, you know, 20 years ago before we had all the tools that we have now, like fiber optic scopes, and we have different types of airways that we can put in people. So the chances of this happening has been less and less and less, has become more and more advanced,
okay.
But it's still a possibility. And if you see somebody that you think that's a possibility, then you have to put the breathing tube in awake.
Got it. Okay.
Now, there's a lot of ways.
So you check out their throat and everything beforehand.
Yeah.
So you're like, okay, this won't be a problem.
There are things that kind of indicate to you that, yeah, this looks like it's not going to be a problem. But you can also look at somebody and say, hey, this is going to be a problem.
So then you do it while they're awake, and how do they withstand that?
You sedate them. Okay. You give them little bits of medication to help relax them.
Oh, God. I'm getting
freaked
out.
But keep them breathing on their own. You topicalize their airway. You give them lidocaine to breathe through so that it numbs up their mouth and their nose.
Mm-hmm.
You can do injections in the neck that get the nerve that comes up to your throat to prevent you from gagging.
Uh-huh.
And if you take your time and you do all those things, then you can put a breathing tube in somebody awake.
And then as soon as you
confirm that the breathing tube's in the right place, then you get them off to sleep.
Because you don't want to be awake being like, am I breathing?
Well, you'd be surprised. If you do a really good job of topicalizing people and preparing them emotionally and preparing them anatomically and medically, there's some people who just will look at you and say, yeah, everything's good, and then you get them off to sleep.
Okay.
But it takes some time. You can't rush through it.
So speaking of horror stories,
that's only like 0.1% that you got to do that. Everybody else—
It's like 1 in every 1,000 cases?
That might be.
Okay.
You know—
So, but to ease everybody's worries out there, because everybody feels like they're going to be like the horror story that wakes up in the middle of the thing. And like, you know how you just said that you paralyze them.
Yeah.
So like they cannot move. They cannot speak. They can't open their eyes. They can't breathe on or like
whatever.
That
is correct.
But how often does it happen? I know that you've probably never experienced this, but like they say it's like 1 in every 300,000 that like somebody's totally witnessing the entire shebang.
Offhand, I don't remember what the statistic is. There's a statistic out there,
like 300,000.
Maybe it is. I really don't know. I'd have to.
But you've never witnessed that.
I've never witnessed that.
Have one of your partners ever?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell us.
Can't tell you anything specific about anybody.
Well, no. Tell us about what the guy experienced.
I don't know. I know that we've had. One of my good buddies, which I won't mention on the air here, is our quality officer, and he's the one who has, you know, the most knowledge about the experiences that we've had in our practice like this. And I'm not in a position that I can really comment on them because I don't know about them specifically. I just do know that we might have one episode of this a year out of all the cases that we do. And if that's true, that would be about 1 in 60,000.
Okay. So that...
And we never... we have to qualify this also. When we were talking about this before, when it was general anesthesia versus sedation, a lot of people remember hearing voices and stuff as they're waking up from their anesthetic.
Yeah.
It's not because they haven't been... They just think, oh, I heard something and, you know... So that's part of it also.
Yeah.
People are misinterpreting. I bet you some people got into the recovery room, and because of all the drugs and everything you get, you knew that there was people around you and people talking to you, people saying, breathe, take big deep breaths.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't mean that you were in the operation and that was happening. It could have been as you were waking up from the surgery that that was happening, or while you were recovering that that was happening.
On our message board, somebody said that they heard somebody like making fun of her body or something.
Well, I can believe that happened. I mean, there have been lawsuits and episodes where people have brought, their iPhones in and recorded things. You got to be very careful what you say when you get people off to sleep.
Yeah, I do remember that. They were, like, making fun of her body and stuff.
That's horrible. Just really put the nail in the coffin on this one.
I did. Let's not talk about nails and coffins. We're talking about putting people to sleep.
True. Okay. That expression.
Let's just have a stick for the heart.
So you say one in 60,000 cases, there might be something like that. But that's usually somebody that maybe, like, isn't an easy anesthetized. Like, if somebody who maybe has other issues going on, you can't say.
Yes, that's a possibility. Okay. You know, it's hard to know. Like I said, some people are harder to get to sleep than others. People make mistakes. You know, we try to do zero harm. That's our goal in medicine, is not, you know, do no harm.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to get to zero harm, but we are humans. We try to put processes in place and checklists and so forth in order to reduce the amount of errors that we make, just like pilots do. But from time to time, these things happen. And like I said, oftentimes it occurs when people are critically ill and we're kind of, our hands are strapped as to what we can give. Although there are stories out there and there have been episodes, and there are probably people who are probably listening to this podcast that, feel very strongly about this and have had bad experiences, and, I believe them.
Mm-hmm. I heard about this company because I saw them on Instagram, and I was like, oh my gosh, I need to get that for Jared because he's always talking about Rhode Island. He's always homesick for Rhode Island. And this company called Homesick Candles creates candles that basically smell like the place that you are homesick of. Homesick from, I guess. It's a great personalized gift because you know how people will be like, oh, here's a candle. You're like, wow, this smells great and like Christmas, but it's not really
personal. But you
probably
got like 15 of them and just
stuck them in a bag and
mass produced them.
Yeah, and you probably have them in a closet just in case you forgot to buy it for somebody. But now, you know, if you buy this kind of candle for the person that you're giving it to, they know that you put thought into it. It's thoughtful. It's personal. It creates an emotional bond. It's also one-stop shopping. So you can basically go to homesickcandles.com and you can personalize a ton of gifts. You know, you'd be like, oh, my friend from there, my friend from there, my friend from there.
Yeah. It's not only a good holiday gift, but it's really good for people going to college, a deployed military, weddings, anniversaries, retirements, visiting friends and family. It's just really good to remind someone of home.
And each candle is made from natural soy wax blend. It's premium cotton wicks, and it's completely non-toxic. Think they're great stocking stuffers, and they have scents that reflect all of the U.S. 50 states and different cities, college towns, and foreign countries.
Right now, our listeners who go to homesick.com and use the promo code GETIT will receive 10% off any order over $50 and get free shipping. Knock out all of your Christmas gifts with this one code, guys. It's a great deal. 10% off in free shipping. Amazing. This amazing offer. And the most popular state and city candles won't last long, so don't wait. Just visit homesick.com and use the promo code GETIT. Find a personal gift for your whole list today.
Okay, Lauren, you can get into your epidural stuff now.
Okay. Well, Dad can get into his epidural stuff now.
Okay. Well, actually, go first, and then I have a little bit of a tidbit.
Okay. Well, people are, you know, choose to not have epidurals for, I guess, a couple of reasons. One is being they don't want to, like, infuse drugs into the baby and have it all natural, whatever, whatever. So Are the drugs affecting the baby?
Yeah. Like, my friend this week told me that her mother-in-law is not okay with her having an epidural. Like, she's telling her daughter-in-law, you can't have one because she thinks she's worried about it harming the baby.
Well, coming from a medical person now, I mean, other people might have their own opinions. The epidural itself, the drugs that you give in an epidural itself does not harm the baby. It doesn't cross the placenta.
No.
Okay. But the effects of the epidural, one of which is low blood pressure, it lowers your blood pressure,
mm-hmm.
and we expect it to. If there's some kind of compromise of blood flow to the from the placenta to the baby to begin with, if you lower the blood pressure too much with an epidural, you can get fetal distress. Now, the way to take care of that is obviously give something to raise the maternal blood pressure. Now, people who get epidurals and deliver nowadays, they monitor the baby. They monitor the baby's heart rate. They do it either directly or indirectly. And there's a normal range of the baby's heart rate. It's usually between 120 and 160. And as long as it's in that range, it's usually okay. It's an indication that it's healthy. And there's also a lot of variability in that heart rate on a baby. It'll fluctuate between 120 and 160. If you lower the blood pressure and the baby's heart rate starts to come down, it's an indication that the baby's distressed.
Okay.
So you give medication to raise the blood pressure. It's something we usually give ephedrine. And you'll find that when the mom's blood pressure comes up, the baby's heart rate comes up and everything gets better.
Does the pain go up then too?
There's no pain.
Okay.
Okay. No pain associated with giving the medication. I don't want to get too complicated because when you look at fetal tracings, there are things called decelerations and accelerations during the course of labor. And certain things are indication that the baby's doing well or doing poorly. But to get back to what we're talking about, the drug itself, giving an epidural, has no effect on the baby. It's only an indirect effect if you lower the mom's blood pressure too much or the mom's breathing becomes labored and she's not getting enough oxygen, then that becomes a problem for the baby. So as long as you place an epidural and you manage the mom's breathing, oxygenation, and blood pressure, there's no effect on the baby.
So when you do get an epidural, it is as if you're kind of being monitored as if you're in surgery.
You are being monitored as if you're in surgery.
And you're numb from wear down.
It depends upon a few things. But generally, it's usually around T6, which is where the tip of your sternum is, the xiphoid.
Mm-hmm.
All right? I mean, you can get as high as T4, which is where your nipple line is.
Yeah.
And then all the way down so you can't move your legs. It depends upon how potent a local anesthetic that you use. Nowadays, we try to use the lowest concentration possible so that you get analgesia, which mm-hmm. means that you're comfortable, but you're still able to move your legs.
I would love that.
There are some things called walking epidurals where the concentration is so low that you can get up and walk around. But generally, you stay in bed.
How do you push if you can't feel your legs?
That's the art of labor or obstetrical anesthesia, is that you want to give enough analgesia that the pain goes away, but not so much of a decrease in sensation that you can't feel the urge to push and to actually push.
I'm getting so nervous over here. Like, I'm getting like nervous farts because
really, because I'm getting less nervous.
But can we?
To
I want to go back again about the epidural because you need to understand the science behind the epidural. Mm-hmm. Before we were talking about a general anesthetic where you're putting the brain to sleep. Well, an epidural, obviously, you're wide awake. You're not putting the brain to sleep. What you're doing is you're getting a local anesthetic placed where the nerves come out from the spinal cord,
mm-hmm.
and it's essentially numbing those nerves. It's preventing those nerves from transmitting information up to the brain.
Got it.
So it kind of gets cut off at the spinal cord level. The impulses don't get from your pelvis to your spine and then up to your brain for you to recognize. Mm-hmm. It just stops them there.
So, if you're gonna get stabbed in the leg, you wouldn't feel that.
If the local anesthetic were potent enough, yes, you wouldn't feel it.
Okay. So you basically are rid of the pain, but you can still feel enough pressure usually?
Yes, that's the perfect kind of anesthetic. You want to reduce the pain, get on analgesia, but you want to have enough sensation so you feel something and you can push.
So mom didn't have an epidural for me because it was all weird and it was... What's your explanation for that?
She went, for, as I remember correctly, for like 1 or 2 centimeters to like fully dilated within like a half an hour.
Ew.
I mean, it was like, it was just like, holy cow.
So there was no time.
When are you supposed to get
it? And you were having D-cells.
What's D-cells?
That's what I told you. It said the contractions of her uterus were so intense.
Oh, I was getting distressed?
Yeah. No. The contractions of her uterus were so intense that it was reducing blood flow to the placenta to get to you. And your heart rate, your fetal heart rate went down.
Oh.
So when they saw that, they said, we're out of here. We're going to go back. They thought she was going to have a C-section. But apparently you calmed down enough that they were able to deliver you with forceps.
Okay, but still, mom didn't have an epidural.
She did not have an epidural
because
for you.
There wasn't. It was too much time. Because the window was too quick.
Yeah, you were already having problems, and to take the time to sit her up to put an epidural in, dude, that would have put you at risk.
Why didn't they just put her on a C-section so that she could at least be a little more comfortable?
You know, there's a lot of reasons why you don't want to put a pregnant woman to sleep.
But C-sections, I watched one in eighth grade when I went to work with you.
Yeah,
the lady was awake.
Yeah, because she had an epidural in.
Okay, so normally with a C-section, you put an epidural in.
Or a spinal.
Okay. But in this case, in my case, they didn't do it because it was just too risky. Too much of a high risk.
Yeah.
Oh, God, what if I have a high risk pregnancy?
Mom always says that once you're at like 2 centimeters, say you're at 8 or something.
Well, you can't. They check you.
No, the contractions. Oh, the contractions. Like 5 minutes apart. Say they're like 1 minute apart.
Yeah, what does mom say that,
Derek? I don't know. You ask your mom that.
Very interesting. I just don't like the feeling of being numb because that makes me feel out of control, which makes me panic more, which makes me freak out, which makes me pass out.
I don't think so.
Well, let's put it this way. When your labor pains get bad enough, you're going to say, I want to be numb.
No, absolutely. I understand that.
So, but with Lauren, mom said that it was like a teeth cleaning with an epidural. Mm-hmm. So do you really, I know you haven't done OB in a while, right?
Oh, yeah.
Do you not do OB anymore?
Just like any other specialty, the more you do it, the better you're at it. So you want the people who are doing it the most to do it all the time. I'm capable of doing it. And I did it for quite some time, but I'm not a fan of OB anesthesia. I like doing what I do in the main operating room where we do all sorts of stuff and do heart stuff too. But generally, docs will gravitate towards a subspecialty of what they're doing because they like to do it and they enjoy doing it. And therefore, you're better at it and you want your patients to have the best people doing it.
So do you, when you would be on OB... Would women just be like, oh my God, thank God, like that was nothing? Or are they still like, holy shit, that was the worst experience of my life, even with the epidural?
Oh, no. People are very, there's not too many more appreciative patients than there are of women who are in labor and you put an epidural and you're like their hero.
The pain of getting the epidural is
not that bad.
No, I remember.
Someone was telling us it was like getting, getting your stem cells. I don't
know.
Getting a biopsy of your spine.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're taking a little needle with local anesthetic and numbing up the skin, and then you're putting a larger epidural needle and placing it into the epidural space.
I'm not concerned about that at all. I remember watching a woman when I went to work with you once get it. And I'd be like, and I was like, this is what people freak out about. Because so many people are like, I can't do it with that needle. I'm like, this woman looks totally fine.
Yeah.
If you're thinking about holiday gifts, you know the obvious one. It's FabFitFun. The winter box is finally here, so treat yourself or somebody in your life, like your sister, your daughter, your aunt, your mom, your cousin, your wife, your girlfriend, your gal pal.
Fiance.
With a FabFit winter box. I kind of was talking to the guys there on some of those, I know, and I know that there's like only 1% of guys that listen to this podcast, but still, cousin, friend, sister, winter box, FabFitFun, totally great gift. You know that I have been using FabFitFun for like 4 years now. Two of my favorite things in this winter box, Oh, there's actually a lot of good things. There's this nude lipstick, super, super good. There's a very cozy blanket scarf. And then there is my favorite beauty tool, underrated beauty tool of all life, and that is a jade roller. Stick it in the fridge, roll on your face in the morning. Freezer. And then you're going to depuff yourself so quickly, and you're going to get all that blood and junk out of your face so that you look like you got perfect bone structure. You guys know probably already that FabFitFun is a seasonal box. So if you get this, it's not just Christmas one time a year or Hanukkah one time a year. It's actually going to be Christmas four times a year with full-size fashion, beauty, home, fitness, and wellness products for just $49.99. But guess what? When you use our code, get it at FabFitFun.com, you're actually going to get the box for only $39.99.
It's great for discovering new brands and products. I've discovered many good moisturizers with this box. So sign up for
exfoliants.
And exfoliants. Sign up for FabFitFun today. FabFitFun boxes make an amazing gift for the holidays. And use our code GETIT to get $10 off your first box. Go to FabFitFun.com to sign up and start getting the box for a life well lived. Use the promo code GETIT to get $10 off your first box. That's over $200 for only $39.99. Go to FabFitFun.com and use the promo code GETIT to get $10 off your first FabFitFun box.
So, okay. Lauren, you have any other questions?
So I want to get back to something else that you talked about. Now, you can do epidurals.
Okay.
Or you can do spinals.
Okay.
All right. Now, people generally women who generally have elective C-sections will have spinal anesthetics placed.
Because
it's quick to do.
Awake.
They're awake, right? They're not in labor. They're not hurting. Mm. But you want to anesthetize them so they don't feel the C-section. Mm-hmm. So they're quick to do. They work much quicker, and they're a denser kind of block than an epidural block is.
Okay. So, therefore, they don't really feel the pressure. They feel nothing.
They feel nothing.
Okay. Why go to sleep for surgeries then if you could just have a spinal and then, be awake with the netting over you?
Well, because it depends upon the kind of surgery you have. If you're going to have lower extremity surgery, a knee replacement, a hip replacement, ankle surgery – you can have a spinal or you can have an epidural for that procedure. It's not a problem.
If you're scared of going to sleep.
Right. But you can't be awake if they're going to go into your belly.
No, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Because they open you up. I mean, you could technically do it because you wouldn't feel it, but because they're going to be putting their hands in you, you wouldn't be able to breathe properly. It just would not be comfortable. Okay?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of different things. Like now they do laparoscopic procedures where they don't do big incisions. They put little holes in and then they blow up your belly with carbon dioxide and they use tools to do it. Well, the way that they blow up your belly with that carbon dioxide puts a lot of pressure in your belly. Mm-hmm. You couldn't breathe if you had a spinal. Okay. Even though you would be numb, you may not feel it, you couldn't breathe.
Okay.
I just have one question that doesn't refer to anesthesia.
I've got a couple non-anesthesia questions too.
The laparoscopic surgery, when you were going to medical school, they weren't teaching you that. So
when I was a resident, back in the early 90s, late 80s and early 90s, laparoscopic cholecystectomies, laparoscopic gallbladder surgeries were just starting at the time. So yes, I started just at the time that they started to do it.
So surgeons like your age had to go back and learn that to keep up with the times?
Correct.
How could they, if they're good with the scalpels and stuff, how do they know they're going to be good with, the computer?
It's a way – you have to get trained. You get trained for it. They have labs where you work on dummies and so forth first. And then you'll work under the guidance of somebody who knows how to do it. But, yes, you have to go back and get trained. Let me tell you, gallbladder surgery, when they used to open you up, could probably take maybe an hour and a half, maybe. Some people probably do it faster. When they first started doing it laparoscopically, it would take 4 and 5 hours. And we would say, anesthesiologists would say, what are we doing here? This is ridiculous. But to their credit, what they saw was instead of having a big incision underneath your rib cage, it set you up for a lot of respiratory problems after and a lot of pain. What they figured is that people would get better and better and better and better at it.
Yeah.
And then if you could take somebody's gallbladder out through a little hole, they wouldn't have to worry about that big incision that they had before and people would recover a lot faster.
Uh-huh.
And that's exactly what's happened. That surgery, which used to take 3 and 4 hours back in the day when they first started doing it, I have surgeons who can do it in 20 minutes, 30 minutes wow. now.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. You have watched some episodes of Grey's Anatomy with me, and a lot of the people on our message boards, they actually have been talking about Grey's Anatomy because it has gotten so bad. Just the scripting is horrible, the relationships are horrible, whatever. We continue to watch it, but you have always, when I was younger and the show was new, you were like, this is such a stupid show that it prevented me from really watching it for years and years because you always talked about how stupid it was. What is like a Grey's Anatomy or medical TV show faux pas that you would like to get rid of for our audience?
Oh, well, the first thing that comes to mind is how dramatic they are. You know, when people, for instance, if trauma comes into the emergency room, it's like, this guy's barking orders. You do this. Yeah. I want this stat. It's just so bad. It's not that dramatic. I mean, there are certain surgeons and certain docs that can be like that. But in general, you know, this is something that you're doing every day. And it's not quite as dramatic as they make it look like on television.
Well, one of the things that happens in almost every other Grey's Anatomy episode is that a patient bleeds out. How often does a patient bleed out?
It depends. I mean, in trauma, it can happen a lot.
So it could happen in the ER every day?
It could happen in the ER. It happens in the OR. I mean, you come in. I'll tell you, the things that bleed the most in trauma are liver injuries and splenic injuries. So if you're in an automobile accident, you fracture your liver or rupture your spleen or something, you can really bleed out bad. Or if it's such a bad accident that you transect your aorta,
yeah, Jesus,
you can bleed out. It's usually traumas that people will bleed out from.
That's not even the craziest shit that happens on Grey's Anatomy. Like,
well, we all
they have
know
like
what
they only have out, like. But 2 cardiac surgeons for the entire hospital.
Well,
yeah.
that may not be 2? Unusual. There's some hospitals that don't have 1. It depends upon how much
okay,
heart
and then they
do.
When they like have a heart transplant, some kind of transplant, the cardiac guy takes it out and then flies it across the country to put it in the new person.
They do that.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought this was bullshit the whole time.
No, I mean, when you do organ transplants, we have, yeah, people fly in from all over the country. Generally, it's regional, you yeah. know. But, yeah, you could have people coming
because
in from all over.
Because whoever's on the next waiting list.
Who's a match. So that's whoever's a proper
yeah,
tissue match.
They fly the organ, but not the surgeon.
The surgeon, they
no,
fly.
No, they're usually surgeons work in teams. So, for instance, you know, my hospital, if we have 8 or 9 cardiac surgeons, that might be overstating it a little bit. But a couple of them do transplants. And they work in teams. There'll be somebody on the team that'll actually go out and procure
uh-huh.
the organ. And there's
you
the other
pick
one.
It up?
They'll pick it up, and then that's right. Well, procure is to not only pick it up; they go out and they will operate on the donor to take it out of them.
Oh, they will, and
yes.
then they'll go and do it
and
to
then,
the person who's receiving.
Well, they'll help out the other surgeon. Potentially, could help out the other surgeon who's going to be putting it in. It doesn't necessarily have to be, but generally, it's not the person who's going out picking it up that's coming back and putting it in. Somebody's
okay,
going
but
out.
Often. Surgeons will travel across the
absolutely.
States.
We get people from, you know, New York City, Johns Hopkins, all over the place.
Is that via helicopter or are you
no,
like –
jets.
So is it like a private jet? Surgeons
yeah,
go
yeah,
on private jets?
There's consortiums. There are transplant consortiums, they're called, that provide all these things. Washington has one. There
Who
are,
the hell knew that Grey's Anatomy was
I
accurate
I honestly
there?
Thought that was one of the most bullshit things they did.
Yeah, me too.
No, that's real.
Okay, so then they also...
Now, there are other organs like kidneys.
Yeah.
Kidneys can get shipped. They get shipped in a box with
like
ice packed in it and everything.
I'm going to overnight this kidney.
Yeah, exactly, because a kidney can be transplanted within 24 hours. It can okay. actually stay outside the body for 24 hours. Now, you want to get it in as fast as possible, but that's one organ that can maintain the ischemic time, meaning no blood flow, because of the preservatives that they pump through it so that it can last 24 hours before you put it
And the heart,
a heart could be like seven.
Yeah, you know? I, you know what? It's been a while since I've done heart transplants. I don't know what the timing is there. There, you like want it. You want it fast because a heart, you know, doesn't tolerate ischemia very well.
Okay, I got one more question about Grey's Anatomy. People, they're always having a patient die on the table during surgery. How often does a patient die on the table?
Not often. No. Again, people who generally die in the operating room are traumas. Yeah. It's infrequent occurrence.
Okay. That's sad and scary.
I have...
I mean, it happens. It happens, but it's an infrequent...
That your last question?
No, I have one more.
Okay, do one more.
I actually have two more. Okay. So today I went to the ENT, the ear, nose, and throat doctor, because I have chronic,
chronic stuffy nose.
If you can't tell, I have a very nasal voice, and it's because I can't really get a lot of air in there, and we got that checked out today. But I told my dad yesterday when I had to go for the CT scan of my sinuses, I was like, why don't everybody just go
why
doesn't everybody just go get a like MRI each year, and that's their checkup? Because can we really figure out through like a doctor's like an internist checkup where they like check your reflexes, your eyes, your pee, and like take some blood if you have a brain tumor or like some other issue? And if we had an MRI each year, we would really be able to see if there is something really growing in our bodies. So, Dad, why don't we do this?
It's more complex than that.
But you did say yesterday that would be an ideal world.
It would be. I mean, that's kind of like Star Trek. You know, I don't know if you watch Star Trek, but they used to put people in this machine and they could figure out what was wrong with them. And I guarantee you that's where we're going to down the road. I don't know how long it's going to be before we get there. But you're talking about, let's just talk about this country alone. There's 330 million people. Mm-hmm. Are you going to scan 330 million people? No, obviously. So you're going to have some cutoff. You're going to say, well, we're going to scan everybody over the age of 40.
Yeah.
And that, well, okay, that cuts us down to what? I don't know, 150, 160 million people? Mm-hmm. You don't have enough scanners and enough time probably to scan that many people. And then how often you're going to do it? You got to decide how often you're going to do it.
Okay, sure. Maybe not once a year, but what about every other year?
I don't know. You're bringing up a good point, and I think we're probably going to get there. I just don't think that it's feasible at this point in time because we haven't gotten there technologically. Well, the other mistake that you're making is that you're implying that every medical problem is an anatomical problem where you have a tumor.
Oh, okay.
That's not true. People have leukemia. People have heart disease. So you can put all those people through the scanner.
So heart disease wouldn't show up on it.
Well, there are scans. There are the things called heart scans where they do calcium scores to see whether or not you have calcium buildup in your coronary arteries and can predict whether you're at risk for heart disease. They're also called MRAs, and they're MRAs or magnetic resonance angiograms, where instead of putting up a catheter into somebody's heart and shooting dye into the coronary arteries, you can see what the blood flow is like. So all I'm saying is you could scan everybody in the world, but there's a lot of medical problems that you're not going to be able to see anything on.
What about... Sure that the dogs are okay down there. What about, the scariest disease I think there ever is, Lou Gehrig's disease. Would that show up on a scan?
Nope.
That's horrifying.
There you go, Ash.
Oh, Lord.
Everyone just, live your life and then hope you don't have anything inside you.
My final question is something.
I love when Ashley plays, what's his name?
I know. James Lipton.
Okay, ask the James Lipton question when you're done.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Dad? We talked about this a couple of days ago. Do you think the drug companies have the cure for cancer, but they're not ever going to release it because they make too much money?
No.
How does it make any sense? If they found the cure for it, then they would have
to
money.
Sell the drug for money.
No. Yeah, for a lot.
They'd be making money off the drug.
Cancer,
right?
Cancer is just not one disease. It's hundreds, if not thousands, of different kinds of cancers that are due to lots of different things. Obviously, it gets down to genetic level, but you know, what one medicine for one cancer does not work for another cancer because there's two different reasons why that cancer has occurred. I don't think there's some kind of grand conspiracy where drug companies are holding on to drugs because of economic reasons.
Because doesn't that not make sense? Because wouldn't they be selling the drug for a ton of money too?
Yeah.
And like, therefore, you'd still have to buy their expensive drugs?
I mean, not necessarily from a, you know, societal perspective. If they had cures for it, you know, you're going to hold people hostage to say, I got this drug to cure you, but it's too expensive. You can't use it. We're not going to give it to you.
No, what do you mean? The people would still, oh, yeah, I don't know. What would you do if you had the cure-all and then you had to pay like $1 million for the
right.
drug?
I mean, you wouldn't do that.
You wouldn't do that?
No.
How could they not do that? Don't they have the right to do that?
They might have the economic right to do it. They don't have the moral right to do it.
Are there moral rights?
We're going far down the field. You know, I'm as entrepreneurial and as, you know, as anybody else, but I do believe that we have some social responsibility to do certain things also, right? I mean,
I hope so.
Ash asked a James Lipton question.
All right, father.
And then I have one James Lipton question.
Oh, really? Okay.
All right, wait, Dad. So, you know, medical shit's a little heavy. Do you have a good doctor joke that you tell people to calm down? Like,
What do you say when you introduce yourself to patients?
You have easing jokes.
Yeah, people love Dad.
Well, I got a couple.
Okay.
You want me to tell them?
Yeah.
Well, you've already heard them.
Okay, I don't care. Our audience has it. There's 60,000 people out there listening.
Well, the one that I usually tell, which is not dirty, is, you know, that whole, why do Norwegian ships have barcodes on the side of them?
Norwegian ships.
You know, why? The Norwegian Navy.
Yeah.
That all their ships,
really?
They have barcodes on the side.
What?
Yes.
Why do they have barcodes on the side?
The Scandinavian.
That's very funny.
Okay. I do have a dirty joke, but I'm not going to tell that on the air.
Do you tell your patients that?
I do, but I tell them don't report me for saying
really?
It.
Really? Does it loosen them up, though?
Oh, they love it.
So you say, I'm going to tell you a dirty joke
it's
right
the
now?
No idea joke, but I'm not going there.
Oh, yeah. I think I've actually told that on the air.
Okay, well, I'm not going there.
Oh, okay, yeah. So Ashley has a James Lipton question.
Well, I do, but now I want Dad to talk about exactly what he says to every patient when he goes in the little pre-op area.
Well, you know, I don't have a canned routine. You know, it depends. All patients are different.
Can you vibe them and be like, oh, she's not going to like jokes?
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes you're wrong. But, you know, there's no real canned talk. You kind of get a feel for the patient. Every patient's different. Every patient has a different level of anxiety. And quite frankly, what we haven't talked about up until now is that part of my job, without giving drugs and so forth, is try to instill a sense of confidence in somebody that you're going to be taking care of them, because that's another unusual thing about my specialty, is that you don't have any relationship with it. You're meeting somebody for the first time before they're having one of the most traumatic things that you can go through.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to giving drugs to make people feel better, you're trying to joke with them a little bit if you think it's appropriate to do and loosen them up. And then what's really important is for you in a very short period of time to convey to them that you're qualified, confident, and experienced enough to take care of them, that they feel comfortable that they're putting their lives in your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So that interaction in the beginning is very, very important.
Going into my surgery, I don't think I've laughed more, honestly. I was like, everything was funny, but then also I got the funny drug.
You got Versed.
Yeah, and I was like, I remember being wheeled in, just giggling my ass
off. You were also super excited to get your nose down.
That's usually what kids and adolescents do when they get Versed. They just they just laugh at everything. Like,
I was like, bye, Dad.
Yeah.
I wish I was there. Wait.
I think you were there, Ashley.
I think I was there.
Yeah,
oh, bummer. You were going into ninth grade, so I was going into 12th grade.
Yeah.
That's so crazy. You were a child.
Yeah. I was a baby.
Okay, Dad, this is the last question. This is our James Lipton question.
What's a James Lipton question?
You know James Lipton from Inside the Actor's Studio?
The what?
Inside the Actor's Studio?
No, I don't know.
No. Okay, well, he asks the same question to every guest.
Yeah. So he goes, if God does exist, what do you want him to say to you when you reach the pearly gates?
You did a good job.
Aw, Dad, that's so nice. nice.
Very good.
He's going to say that.
Okay. I hope so.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening and buy all the ads that we do because I need your support in life.
Because Lauren has to move out soon.
I got to move out. So it would be really helpful. Also, rate, subscribe, and join our Facebook group because it is lit AF in there.
Yeah. And we also love it when you guys write in the message board about what you thought about every episode. We really do. That's our favorite
Very
feedback
constructive
of the week.
Criticism yeah. as well.
So thank you so much. We love you. Dad, do you have any last words?
Love you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. I don't
get it. Podcast. This podcast is brought to you by Wave Podcast Network. Check out all of our shows, including the Brain Candy Podcast, I Don't Get It, Babes and Babies, Coffee Convos, and Let's Talk About It.